number 52492, Borman versus Nevada Memorial Cremation Society. Counsel, are you ready to present? Okay. Yes, if you would. If you'll come up here, counsel. Oh, yes. Okay, then actually what I'll do is have appellants. You can both kind of fill in your version of the facts if there's any difference in the facts, but I'll have appellants present theirs first.
Yes, good morning to everybody. I'm, of course, Jonathan Kapp, and I represent the appellants and the plaintiffs in this matter. And basically, as far as the factual allegations are concerned, these facts involve the missing organs of a British citizen, a resident of London, Richard Borman, who, when he was 29, he came to Las Vegas with three of his mates, his friends from England. They basically had a bit of fun when they were here, obviously, indulged perhaps in too much alcohol and drugs. And on the day before they were due to return to London, effectively, Mr. Borman collapsed and died in a nightclub in the Mandalay Bay Hotel. He was, of course, taken to the local hospital. The hospital did everything they could for him. They put him on life support, but that was basically to no avail. Subsequent to his death, he was transported to the Las Vegas coroner's office, who autopsied him. They removed all his internal organs. Subsequent to that, his body was transported to a local funeral home where his body was embalmed, and then he was flown back to London. This is, where the controversy arises. 2 weeks after his death, or around about 2 weeks after his death, he arrived back in London, and the British coroner, seeing that there was no cause of death on the death certificate, which had been provided by the Nevada authorities, opened up the Y-shaped incision, which had been made by the Las Vegas coroner, and to his shock and amazement, found there was no organs in his body. There was no liver, kidneys, heart, anything like that. All the British coroner found, the officer in London found, was a rolled-up white sheet. Upon seeing that, the British authorities contacted the authorities in Las Vegas, and they were basically told that the organs had been returned in the body to London. So basically, this is a case of missing organs. As put by the plaintiff's essential claim is that these organs were removed by the Las Vegas coroner subsequent to an autopsy, and then subsequent to them being removed, somehow went missing. The claim of the plaintiffs is that the organs somehow were lost, stolen, they don't really know, and the basic claim of the plaintiffs is, and the appellants, of course, is that not only the coroner's office, but also the funeral home who claimed that they embalmed the body, who claimed that they put the body in the plane with the organs within it, are basically conspiring together to engage in a cover-up. And essentially, the gravamen of our action is that the loss of the organs, and not only the loss of the organs, but the subsequent cover-up, which we believe has taken place, has caused severe emotional distress to several of the relatives in London, namely the the mother, the younger brother of Mr. Borman, or in fact two younger brothers of Mr. Borman, and other close family members, including the first cousin and a grandmother. So that's basically our case. What we're basically saying is this poor fellow comes to Las Vegas for 4 days. He probably parties a little bit too much, as we say, and he dies, of course, and he's returned to London with his without his internal organs, which we claim were somehow lost or taken by the coroner's office, and there's some kind of cover-up involving the coroner and the embalmers, the people who work in the funeral homes, to deny and conceal these facts.
And then before I start the clock on you, could you do this for me? Would you explain the procedural posture of this and why we're here in particular today?
Yes, the procedural posture is this. We eventually filed a complaint with the United States District Court, with the federal court here in Las Vegas, against the coroner's office and the funeral home. The coroner's office, of course, filed a motion to dismiss, basically saying that on these facts we cannot cause we cannot state various causes of action. And in particular, what they're saying, of course, is that we have no claim on any analysis for negligent and intentional infliction of emotional distress. We obviously dispute that. We responded to that, and basically the district judge really couldn't know, because of course there's no precedent on this in the state of Nevada, and he obviously requested your honors or this court to basically tell him what the law is as far as missing organs and what claims relatives may have and which relatives may have the claim. I think that accurately states why we're here today.
I think that does. Ms. Reffel, have you got anything to add to the facts that you would like to correct? Okay, I'm going to have you do that now. Yeah. Please.
I just want to emphasize a couple things. First of all, when an autopsy takes place at the coroner's office, as a matter of routine, the organs are removed. Oftentimes, they are tested, examined, samples are taken to determine the cause of death. And in this case, after the organs have been removed and they're done with the autopsy, they place the organs in a bag. It's called a viscera bag. Viscera is also means organs. It's another term for organs. And at the time the coroner completes the investigation, the body is transferred to, usually it's a mortuary, to the appropriate mortuary. And the body, along with the bag of organs, is transferred together. The organs remain separate from the body, but they're transferred together. And in this case, at the conclusion of the autopsy, the organs and the viscera left the coroner's office and went to the mortuary, who's named as a defendant in this case. It's called Nevada Funeral Services. There is authenticated evidence on the record that the organs, along with the body, of course, got to that mortuary. And that evidence is testimony by a Clark County employee named Monique Beverly. She testifies that she saw the organs, along with the body, go to Nevada Funeral Services. The employees from that organization came to pick them up from the coroner's office. And more significantly, an employee of Nevada Funeral Services testified under oath at his deposition that the organs and the body were in their possession. He discusses a conversation he had with a coworker at the time they were embalming the decedent's body, and they're talking about, well, should we put the organs and the bag in the chest cavity of the decedent and seal it up, or should we just separate the organs and put them in there without the bag itself? My point is, the evidence shows that the organs were transferred from the coroner's office to the mortuary. There's no evidence whatsoever to the contrary, and there's no evidence of any kind of conspiracy or collusion that plaintiffs seem to claim. The other thing I want to mention is that the county has filed a motion for summary judgment. The co-defendants, Nevada Funeral Services, have not joined in.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, Mr. Kapp, we'll go ahead and start the timer on you.
My time is... Oh, sorry. Okay, I guess it starts now. I think as far as the legal argument is concerned, as far as answering the questions asked of your honors by the district courts concerned, I guess our major submission is this, is that it's important to distinguish between an emotional distress claim or negligence action, however you want to frame it, between when you have a direct victim as opposed to a bystander case. And I think this is the essential, this is the essential distinction. And obviously that distinction, in our opinion, obviously affects public policy. Whereas in a bystander case, say, best example I can give, if, say, there's an automobile accident and somebody's rear-ended and there's people on the sidewalk close by and see a horrible injury or a particularly horrific accident, obviously, in that case, a Supreme Court in any state has to ask itself the question, or the question, how do we apply public policy to determine how a bystander in that particular instance can have some claim for emotional distress. Contrary to that, or in the obvious, and then we have a direct victim case, and obviously our basic submission is that what we're talking about here is a direct victim case. How would a Supreme Court, in applying public policy in its own particular state, try, if they wanted to, try to limit any way in which a direct victim could recover? I mean, in the example I've just given you, in a car that's just been rear-ended, obviously the occupants of the car are direct victims. It's reasonably foreseeable that somebody, if they negligently operate a motor vehicle, if they impact another vehicle, it's reasonably foreseeable that the occupants of that car are going to suffer some kind of injury, whether it be physical or whether it be pain and suffering, which might imply that they do suffer some kind of emotional or emotional discomfort. In that case, the occupants of the car are in the zone of foreseeability of the actions of the individual who's driving a car negligently on the road. And obviously, there's no real public policy reason why any injury they suffer, whether they be emotional or physical in that car, should be restricted. Whereas, of course, a bystander, somebody standing on the sidewalk, that's obviously a completely different situation. And courts have applied... or balanced various factors to determine under what circumstances a bystander can recover. And obviously, I'm going to refer to the major case, which is all over our brief. That's the case of Christensen, decided by the California Supreme Court, and they actually set those factors out, and I put them in the brief, and basically they say, was the transaction or was the action intended to affect the plaintiff? What's the foreseeability of harm of the act that was committed? What's the degree of certainty that a plaintiff might suffer some injury as a result of the complained of act? And the act I'm talking about now is somebody driving a motor vehicle. What's the closeness between the defendant's conduct and the people who are claiming the injury? What's the moral blame? What's the level of moral blame of the person, of the actor, the person who's committing the tort? And how do we apply public policy to prevent future harm?
Do you differentiate between county in terms of the duty that's owed and the standing of the people to assert the claims?
Well, in the only differentiation I would make, I would say that because the coroner is basically a police force. In most countries, the coroners are part of the police force. They are holding a police function. I think their duty is greater. As we say in our brief, I believe that certainly as far as investigating what happened to the organs, they actually owe a higher duty because they're a public official. But as far as mishandling the organs are concerned, no, I believe it's the same. I believe they're both doing the same basic function. What they're doing is they are handling a body, and they're under an obligation to respect that body. And the major reason why you respect a body is because you don't want to offend the wishes and sensibilities of the relatives, of the people who obviously have an interest in burying that person.
Procedurally, why is the funeral home not part of the briefing in this case? I recognize they didn't join the county's motion, but is there some side stipulation or order as to the funeral home?
No, there isn't. No, I just believe they just didn't join the county's motion. It's as simple as that.
Mr. Kapp, your argument under Christensen is interesting in some respects because in that case, as I understand it, limited the scope of plaintiffs to the parents. Are you arguing for broader coverage of plaintiffs? And if so, what's the public policy that supports extending the right of other plaintiffs to pursue a claim?
No, I don't believe they did. I believe Christensen says that I believe Christensen spoke about close relatives. I don't believe they just limited it to the parents at all. I don't believe Christensen says that. I think Christensen's basic view was it was a question of fact for the trier of fact, They followed another California case called Casida, which actually said that a niece could conceivably be amongst the plaintiffs, and it certainly included people, relatives who lived in the same household. I believe California authorities talk about close family members or people living in the same household. I don't believe that they limited it to the parents, but I could be wrong.
You're correct. I was referring to Morton versus Maricopa County, where Arizona does make that distinction. It seems as though the courts are divided as to whether, as to who should be able to bring this type of claim, whether it should be the parents, other close relatives, or, as some states have done, a person named in a statute who has the right to control the body for purposes of burial or cremation. This court hasn't addressed this. What do you feel the rules should be and why in this court versus those competing interests?
Well, yes, I believe that the rule should be that anybody in the zone of foreseeability, if you like, should be able to sue. And that certainly would include close family members. And when I say close family members, I'm talking about the first bloodline, so that would be parents, siblings, children. I believe that it certainly would involve people living in the same household. And it could also involve close family members who aren't first bloodline. So it could be a niece. It could be an aunt. It could be somebody else. It's really, I mean, our basic submission is the way Your Honor should view this. You should say this is a direct. This is basically negligence. This is not a bystander case. You should basically say, looking at the actual act of preparing a body, it's reasonably foreseeable that if the body's not prepared properly, if the organs are lost, if the body's defaced, if the relatives or people are suffering because they don't know what's happened to the organs, if you're covering this fact up, if you're lying to them, if you're not telling them the truth, it's reasonably foreseeable that people will be affected by that, and they will be emotionally affected by that. And the question is, who are those people?
And Mr. Kapp, isn't there some difference? We have people that are affected, but these people are already under a great deal of stress because of the demise of their loved one. So how do we know that this emotional distress you're talking about is real? Should we even consider that? As well as the fact that we have two different type of cases. We have cases where the relatives are in that zone of danger, so to speak. They see the casket is dropped, they see a body, versus this type of situation where the injury is behind closed doors. The family members aren't there to witness it. Do we need that?
Well, in a sense, although the autopsy, although it was conducted behind closed doors, although this conspiracy we're talking about was obviously hatched behind closed doors, the real impact or the real injury arises when the family are, one, told the organs are missing, and moreover, are told we don't know what happened to them. And obviously, people are extremely distressed, obviously, when somebody dies, but this adds to the distress. This makes the distress all the more unbearable. The fact that the body can't be properly buried, the fact that there's no closure, the fact that they don't know what happened to these organs makes matters worse. And I guess, on a point of public policy, I can see Your Honor's point. Your Honor may be saying, well, how can we ever determine that? How can we ever decide that?
Mr. Kapp, I mean, when it's said and done, what you're asking someone to do, that's not our case here, is to attach a dollar figure to this loss.
That's true of any loss, I assume. And I assume that's for the jury to determine. That's why we have trials of fact. It's not like a breach of contract case where you can attach a dollar figure.
So what would the jury instruction look like if a niece was suing as opposed to a parent or a child?
I think the jury instruction would say something along the lines of, firstly, the person has to have suffered this emotional distress. Then I think the jury instruction would have to say something like, the jury has to be satisfied that was a person for whose benefit the the autopsy or the body was handled. And I think the jury would have to ask themselves, when you talk about whose benefit, was that somebody who was a close enough relative that they would be emotionally distressed by these circumstances? It has to, it's really a case of, I think public policy is correct when they cut it off to relatives, but I think it has to be a close enough relative, and there are cases where the niece may be closer to somebody than a brother, or the grandmother may be closer to somebody than a father. It really is a question of fact for the jury to decide. But I would expect a jury instruction along the lines of saying, is that relative sufficiently close to the tortious act, so it's foreseeable that they could be. Well, I would use something along the lines of benefit. I think the word benefit's a good word to use, because I think that it has to be said that whether it be a coroner or a funeral home, they're obviously handling the body, they're obviously preparing the body, they're obviously giving the body respect and decorum, because they must know that they're doing that so that their loved ones, to coin a phrase, want to see that body in a fine state to be buried and give it its last rites.
Should there be a difference if the deceased is a child versus an adult as to who can make the claim? Should there be a difference
in our
jurisprudence, especially since we're being asked this by the federal court? So whatever we say is going to be the law of the land, or at least this land.
Right.
So should there be a difference if the deceased is a child versus an adult that has passed away?
Well, that's a question of fact for the jury, I believe. I don't believe there's any legal difference. No, I believe the law should be that it should be somebody for whose benefit the service was rendered, and that comes into zone of foreseeability. And on a point of public policy, it's reasonable to cut that off at perhaps at blood relatives. I think that might be a reasonable thing to do. Although, I suppose, it could be argued if somebody's lived with somebody for 20, 30 years, partnered somebody for 20, 30 years, there's no reason why that should happen. But
what about a nanny with a child?
A nanny with a child? I think for the intentional tort, I don't see why not. I think for intentional, if it's an intentional wanton act, and if it's on these facts where you've got somebody exercising police power, as we claim, and we believe we'll win on this, covering something up, I believe anybody within the shotgun, anybody within the zone can sue. I think for intentional, yes. For negligence, because we're going down to the moral culpability question, I believe maybe you have to draw the line somewhere for public policy reasons, and maybe if a nanny's not a blood relative, maybe not.
Addressing public policy, briefly, you made an interesting claim for conversion. As a policy matter, how do you propose you value a body part for purposes of conversion? And is that a wise public policy decision for us to make to support that kind of claim?
Well, I think, first of all, the conversion claim is more of an interference with a property right. It's not necessarily saying that we put a certain dollar amount on an organ. It's more of an interference of the right, the quasi property right of the person in the pecking order to have custody of the body.
Doesn't that argument undermine your duty issue as far as the coroner's office is concerned? If it's a property interest, does that affect your duty argument?
Not in the slightest, because I think that a conversion is a different cause of action to emotional distress. I mean, I think it might be fair to say that this pecking order, which of course every state seems to have, it might be fair to say that the conversion cause of action is restricted to the person in the pecking order, in this case the mother. I think that it's the same damage, in the sense that, well, it might not necessarily be the same damage. If, for example, the coroner profited from selling these organs, I think you can put a value on them. I think in this day and age, I think, especially with medical science where it is, I think you could call expert testimony to say what an organ's worth were it sold on the open market.
So Mr. Kapp, your theory of liability against the coroner's office is that
they operate some way in a police function, and that creates the duty of liability to your clients?
No,
assuming such a claim exists?
No, it's not really. I mean, it just. I think it was in response to the question by the Honourable Justice there. I think that the fact that they have a police function makes them all the more liable, makes what they've done all the more intentional, makes what they've done all the more reprehensible, because they have a police function. I mean, they basically investigated themselves in this case and, of course, cleared themselves. And I think that goes to the fiduciary duty. I think that goes to the reckless intent of what they've done. It goes to the intentional element of the emotional
distress. But you're alleging straight negligence as against the county in addition to the other claims.
Yes, and we are. Yes, we've added.
What do you make of, are you familiar with the Sado case out of the Ninth Circuit where they declined to recognize as a matter of law a negligent handling of the remains against the National Investigative Service, saying the investigative function was disrespectful of the remains, but there wasn't a duty running? Even under Christensen, they were applying California law under the Federal Tort Claims Act.
Distinguishing
between the investigative function that the coroner or an investigative service may conduct versus the care of the body that a funeral home may conduct.
Well, absolutely, and I think there's an important distinction to make. I think on the facts of this case, because they're basically investigating, there's a difference between a coroner investigating why somebody else died and doing a bad job of it. Of course, then there's a lot of immunity there because they have, like, public policy says we can't sue a police force just because they perhaps mishandle an investigation. But in this case, they're investigating themselves. They actually investigated themselves. They concluded that there was no wrongdoing. And our basic claim is that they didn't properly investigate it. And moreover, they provided false documents. And
so if they had not done that and they had stopped at simply losing the organs, would you say that there's no claim?
I would say, had this, if things were different, they would be different. If say, for example, the coroner had done this, let's say, for example, they'd lost the organs, and when the coroner from London called them up and said, well, where are these organs? If they said, sorry, we've lost them, we don't know what happened to them, we're really sorry, I don't think we'd be here today, no.
As against them, you wouldn't be here at all. So you would concede that there's no, if they had made a clean breast of it, you would have no claim. You make that concession?
Well, I'm not saying we would have had no claim. We probably wouldn't have filed a lawsuit because if people make mistakes, they make mistakes. I would say that we would have a claim because there's still... I would say we would have a claim simply because if a coroner loses the organs, they've committed a negligent act which had that caused severe emotional distress. Had the plaintiff said, well, you know, we're so distressed about what they've done, we would have a claim, but I don't know whether or not that would have happened. I mean, their conduct goes far and above the example that Your Honour's just given me. But yes, I think if somebody loses organs, I think that's negligence per se, and I think that.
If a police officer did say there was a terrible automobile accident and organs were lost? Where would you be with your argument?
I think that losing organs is. It's hard to imagine how anybody could lose organs. I think that's gross negligence, frankly. To lose any body part, it shows such a disrespect for body parts. I would say that would be grossly negligent, and that would entitle the close relatives to sue for negligent infliction of emotional stress and actually negligence.
All right, Mr. Kapp, you're out of time. We appreciate your arguments. Colleagues, do you have anything else for Mr. Kapp? Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This court specifically asked that the arguments be emphasized, or three issues be emphasized within the argument. And one of those issues is, well, what is the relationship of a plaintiff to a decedent to bring a tort claim of emotional distress arising from mishandling of human remains? It is the county and Monique Beverly's position that It is a person with the superior right to the body who has the standing to bring not just emotional distress claims arising from mishandling of human remains, but any tort claim whatsoever. And this is pursuant to NRS 451.025, as that statute sets forth the authority for burial and lists persons in the order of priority who have the right to the body. And in this case, since there was no written directive by the decedent, he doesn't have a spouse or an adult child, the mother, and only the mother, is the person who is alive to, and has the existence to have the standing to sue.
But Ms. Rayfield, oftentimes in estate planning work, lawyers will designate a corporate trustee to act as an executor or to assume the lease responsibilities in the event someone dies. Do you really think we should adopt a rule that gives, for example, Nevada State Bank the right to bring an emotional distress claim for the loss of body parts for the body instead of the parents or the children of that decedent?
No, and I haven't seen any cases that don't address that type of a statute to anything other than a person. In fact, I believe there's a case out of Alaska where they had the executor of an estate who brought the claim, and in that case they held that it had to be a person who actually had the statute, the right to the body for burial purposes. I don't know, I'm not familiar with estate law, but my thinking is that a bank wouldn't have the right to the body for burial purposes.
So it would be your position that if I accept what they're saying is true, we have a wrong, but we should not have any redress for that wrong under that circumstance?
Well, that may ultimately be the answer here, but the redress would be brought, if there were any, it would be brought by the person with the right to possession of the body, and in this case,
but yours,
it is the mother.
But what you're giving us, go ahead.
That would be that person would have the right to seek tort claims if in the mishandling of a human remain context. And that there's several cases that support this. The state of Maryland, Florida, like say Alaska, and notably Tennessee, they don't formally adopt a separate tort for mishandling remains, such as that in the second restatement of torts, but they apply their own tort law and apply the principle that the person with the superior right to the body may bring those claims. Now, that Christensen case out of California has been distinguished, as Justice Pinkering mentioned, by the Sable case. It's also been distinguished by another case out of California. It's an appellate court case, however. It's 2007 case. It's Melikin v. University of California, 59 California, Reporter 3rd at 672. And in that case, the university performed research on donated bodies, and the court found it didn't have the same duty as a mortuary with respect to handling remains. And in this case, we're dealing with a coroner as it relates to the family, not a mortuary as it relates to the family. The coroner doesn't contract with the family. The coroner doesn't provide services to the family. The coroner doesn't do embalming, visitation, viewing, or cremation. The coroner is a department of, in this case, a public entity, Clark County, and its duty is to the community to investigate into the cause of deaths, certain deaths that occur
here.
Don't
they have some duty to act reasonably under the circumstances, which would mean not to lose things entrusted to them?
I don't advocate that they don't. In this case, they did not lose anything. I'm just saying there's a difference between applying the extending standing to all close family members aware of services and for whose benefit they're performed, as the Christensen case did, and showing how that ruling was really truly caters to a mortuary relationship with the family and not a coroner relationship with the family.
But isn't that slightly contra? I mean, we've imposed duties on law enforcement officers when they're doing their job to do it in a reasonable manner. Likewise, wouldn't we confer a duty on the coroner's office to do their job in a reasonable manner?
I think they
we can't needed. Just obviate them and say, well, because you have no relationship with the family, you can just do your job willy-nilly as you see fit.
Well, in this situation, we get into issues with respect to spurious lawsuits, fraudulent lawsuits. We want to make sure the lawsuits are as genuine and with as much merit as they should be in this case.
Let me ask you this: on how would you articulate the duty that the coroner has and to whom? There's some jurisdictions that will articulate the duty as a property interest in these kind of cases, as opposed to a duty to the next of kin.
The duty outlined in the Clark County Code does not create a private right of action, but it does say when the coroner completes, I'm paraphrasing, when the coroner completes its investigation, the body is to be turned over to the next of kin. It releases the body to the next of kin.
Your brief is, I wanted to ask about your brief, on page 24, you're answering the question whether the coroner has a duty to the family members regarding the lost body parts. And on line 15, you say yes. There's not much analysis. But then the rest of your argument seems to say no. I'm confused. Does the coroner have a duty of liability to someone, a family member, or as you argue under Alaska law, a person who has the right to the body, if the body parts are lost? And if so, what's the source of that duty?
Well, if the coroner lost, misplaced, or misappropriated the remains, and like I say, they did not do this in this case. If they're dead, if they did, there could be recovery so long as they fulfilled the elements of the tort claims for which they were seeking.
So you're saying you're requiring a physical manifestation or physical impact?
Yes.
So, but you are conceding in this argument that the coroner has liability for a negligent, for a NIAID claim if other elements are satisfied. Is that what you're saying?
I think there's a possibility that, not under these facts, but maybe under some other facts,
well, let's
they
assume
could.
These facts. The plaintiff argues in this case that the organs were lost. I know you dispute that factually, but let's assume for the moment, for purposes of this question, that the coroner lost the organs. You're conceding that the coroner has a duty to the family member who's entitled to the body, and that survives at least summary judgment on the duty issue.
I would say that if the family, or in this case the mother, could prove all of the elements of the claim for which she seeks, physical injury manifesting emotional distress.
We know that there are several elements for a viable claim. The first one is, does the coroner have a duty to the mother as a matter of law? Are you conceding that?
I would say the coroner probably does. If the coroner were to actually lose the organs and acted in some negligent fashion, it could possibly have a duty.
Well, if that's true, what's the source of that duty? Because you argue that the statute, or the county ordinance that obligates the coroner to turn the body and the body parts over does not create a private right of action. So I'm trying to understand what the source of the duty is that the coroner owes to some family member, whether it's the mother or the children or whomever. What's the source of that duty? The coroner, by law, is obligated to perform an autopsy.
Correct.
So they perform the autopsy, they misplace or lose the organs, let's say not intentionally. What's the source of the duty for the coroner to do that? To have liability.
Perhaps there isn't one. I have cases that indicate that in some jurisdictions they bring them, whether they're successful or not, they're brought through emotional distress claims of mishandling remains.
Under the restatement, second and third, and most of the cases, these are issues against mortuaries. Coroners.
There are a couple against coroners. Maricopa County involves a coroner.
Ms. Rayfield, let me ask you this. Assuming for the sake of argument there were a duty between the coroner and the family of the deceased, how would you characterize that duty? Would it be fiduciary? fiduciary or be a special relationship?
No, it would not be fiduciary duty. I have found no case law whatsoever showing that there's a fiduciary relationship, and no case law has been presented to me in the briefing by the plaintiffs as well. With that special relationship, a fiduciary duty by law so requires that special relationship, which is tied into fiduciary duty. Like I say, there's no fiduciary duty, but also a special relationship was mentioned in the Christensen case, but it's more of an, in California, it's an exception to the rule that the plaintiffs need to show that physical injury or illness manifested from emotional distress in those negligent infliction of emotional distress cases. So
if
there's
were a special relationship, you wouldn't necessarily have to show physical injury.
In California.
Well, in Nevada,
in,
too.
Okay.
Okay. Sutton versus University, UNLV. This guy was the trial judge on that. In that case, you had a situation where a professor was fired from the university here and sued for emotional distress, and because there was a special relationship between the employer and employee, the Supreme Court held that you didn't have to show physical injury to establish a claim for emotional distress.
I don't see that special relationship between the coroner and the family in this case, nor do I see this as a direct victim case. This is a bystander case. There was no act committed against the plaintiffs by the defendants. There's no tort done against the plaintiffs by the defendants. They need to be present to observe the offending act, as mentioned in Eaton and State v. Eaton and other negligent infliction of emotional distress cases. The act was as to the organs of the decedent, not as to the plaintiffs in this case. There's an Illinois case on point, Leonard v. Kurtz, and that's supports this position.
Counsel, as to those organs you just spoke of, as the conversion issue, traditional conversion and the argument offered by counsel as to interference with control of property, how do you respond?
Can you please repeat that?
This was as the conversion issue?
Yes.
And the traditional conversion issue, whether or not there's a value to these organs, or as counsel has asserted, this interference with control of property. Do we have it?
There's no market value to these organs. There's no value to these organs whatsoever.
That's a traditional approach. He also argued, though, there was an interference with control of that property. It would allow him to proceed as to a conversion claim.
The conversion cases I looked at, the majority clearly states that there's no property right in a dead body. That seems to be the majority opinion.
We are sitting, though, with no law in our state. Should we openly adopt that, or should we look a different way, as counsel was indicating? There is possibly a value to that where it can be sold. That's a strange set of facts for this particular case, but are we limited since we're answering these questions at the request of the federal court?
Well, there's also a couple of cases that say a quasi-property right does not extend, that the property right does not extend to the organs. And actually, they're referring to a quasi-property right, meaning that there's no property right in a dead body, but the person who has a superior right to the body for burial purposes has a quasi-property right in the body for burial purposes only. So I advocate that we should stop it. We should not allow conversion on a dead body. I have not seen the cases that support.
Have you seen any conversion cases that post-date the fairly wide adoption of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act?
Not that I don't know the date of that act.
2007 in Nevada. The purpose of that question is that recognizes a right to control the disposition of organs to research facilities or to others. People sign driver's licenses directing organ gifts, et cetera. I'm concerned about the ramifications of no recognition of a conversion claim in that setting and what the policy implications of that are, both pro and con. And I was asking whether there are any cases addressing conversion modernly given those acts.
I have a 2007 case out of California Perryman versus County of Los Angeles.
That's unpublished, though, right? And non-cited.
It, at the time this brief was written, it was not unpublished. Since then, I, when preparing for the argument, I have realized that it has some issues.
The Conroy case, though, might.
Yes, the Conroy case super kind of encompassed the Perryman case.
May she finish?
Yes. Yes. Go ahead and finish your thought.
But I think of the Conroy case, I'm going off the top of my head here, is favorable to this position that these plaintiffs shouldn't have a conversion right of action for a dead body. And there's several cases involving where they're doing anatomical work or donating organs or studying the bodies that hold that the family doesn't have a right to the return of these organs at all.
Thank all right. Colleagues, any other questions? All right. Ms. Redfield and Mr. Kapp, thank you for your very interesting arguments today. You may go ahead and have a seat. What I